Imagine you can't buy your food anymore, you can't pay your rent, you can't pay your insurance, you can pay nothing from one moment to the other. So, what to do?
In the German, there was no legal decision over this, there was no court case. They just didn't even tell you, they just shut it down.
No, they didn't tell me. No, no, nothing.
And how did you survive?
Yeah, I'm a creative person. I had some money, of course. I'm lucky, some cash. And they told me I can go to the church and to tell my story.
So the state told you that? The state told you go to the church?
No, my bank officer told me that. Because I asked him, what shall I do now? And he told me, oh, maybe you can go to the church.
The German government is still attempting to imprison Alina Lipp for her work in Donbass. Now, I've seen the court documents, and the reasons they give are that Alina has reported that Ukraine has been killing its own people in Donbass for 8 years, and that the majority of people there support Russia. Now, these are two undeniable facts. Perhaps the most worrying aspect of this case is that her court order effectively criminalizes honest reporting in Ukraine. Because if you're a journalist, mainstream or otherwise, or a political figure, and you want to point out these two very important facts, you risk going to jail, raising questions about Germany's ability to make sensible policies on Ukraine.
As they see Elena as an enemy of their narrative, her message as a threat, they want to make Elena's move impossible by blocking the financial capability and creating a psychological pressure. They are distorting her focus out from the things what she were doing before, and I mean seeking the truth and telling the truth to the German audience, and that is their target. And when they are succeeding of disturbing her job, then they think that they are winning the battle.
Yes, I think that the governments in Europe, because I'm not the only case, prosecute the parents of journalists, because we, of course, get support of our parents. They support us maybe also. It's the fact that if they close my bank account, probably the parents will help out. For me, it's an act of a suppressive state or even terror state. I don't know what's going on in Germany now.
While WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange languishes in a British jail, and French journalist Adrien Bouquet recently survived an assassination attempt in Turkey, he suspects by the Ukrainian SBU, for Alina and her mother, it's exile. The threat to Western journalists who challenge the mainstream with uncomfortable truths is growing. Johnny Miller, Crimea.
England and Wales football associations are pushing ahead with plans to peddle political messages at this year's World Cup football tournament hosted by Qatar. In a joint statement with 8 other European federations, England and Wales insisted they will continue to press off-field issues in spite of a FIFA plea to focus on football.
National teams and their players choosing this sporting event to push their Western worldview so blatantly onto the Arab world is unprecedented, creating a culture war at an event which is supposed to remain free from politics.
Doha has come under fire for its human rights record, including poor treatment of migrant workers who built the competition's infrastructure. But the criticism also goes further, with activists attacking Qataris over their religious and cultural beliefs too, such as bans on alcohol, premarital relations, and Western LGBTQ culture. However, onlookers from the Muslim world have been less impressed by the anti-Qatar bandwagon.
We obviously know that they're very hypocritical. And, for example, on the Ukraine issue, you know, basically politics is coming to sport, you know, when the West feels like it. But the West cannot have it its own way all the time. And this is a World Cup, the first World Cup in an Arab and Muslim country. They need to go there and respect the culture. Muslim sportsmen coming to the West do not necessarily, they don't insist that the West stops invading foreign countries before playing sport or prohibit gambling and, you know, pornography and all this kind of stuff, which is prevalent in the West, you know, because we realize that different countries have different cultures. And when you go to somebody else's country, you obey the law and you respect the country, you respect the local culture. And if you don't like it, you leave.
This is the first time that the World Cup has ever been hosted in the Middle East. Qatar's authorities have promised to provide a welcoming environment to all. This week, Doha's foreign minister responded angrily to what he called European arrogance and double standards. Many expect that activists on and off the pitch will stage protests throughout the competition. How Qatari authorities will police this remains to be seen. Robert Carter, London.
U.S. President Joe Biden recounted his trips to Afghanistan in a recent speech to war veterans, including one in 2008 in which he was stranded in snow. In his remarks, he repeatedly disparaged Afghanistan as a godforsaken place. The Taliban say his words are out of frustration.
We don't know on what basis they've stated such a thing, but Afghans continue to live their normal lives. There is no need for the U.S. cooperation and help. Such statements are made out of frustration and envy. In any case, God willing, Afghans live their normal lives and build their country themselves.
People here say nearly two decades of U.S. presence in Afghanistan didn't have any positive impacts on their lives. They say the American forces committed countless war crimes and destroyed basic infrastructure in many areas.
The U.S. has not served any country it has entered. The U.S. considers its own interests wherever it goes. There is no improvement in the lives of Afghans, as you see, and people are poor.
The U.S. was in Afghanistan for 20 years, and now Biden says Afghanistan is a godforsaken country. The main factor to that is the Americans themselves who created disorder in this country.
The U.S. ended its occupation of Afghanistan in August 2021, but shortly after that, the Biden administration imposed sanctions on the country and froze billions of dollars worth of assets belonging to Afghanistan, leaving the country in a difficult economic situation. People say the ongoing war in Afghanistan is an economic one. Many are striving to survive while billions of dollars of their assets are frozen by the U.S. Abdullah Amirzad, Kabul.
It is blatantly obvious that Brussels is losing its energy war with Moscow as prices across the 19-country eurozone continue to skyrocket. Washington is benefiting by selling gas to the EU at a high price. Eurozone finance ministers met on Monday to assess the crisis.
We are focusing now also within the European Commission, within the General Council, how we can, and then also with the ministers of energy that are focusing on how we can reduce that cost in the near future.
The poorest are feeling the pain most. Eye-watering amounts have been spent to try and compensate.
Euro area governments have so far collectively spent about 1.25% on energy supports for the year, so about 200 billion euro.
Of course, it's all linked to the EU's attempts to isolate Russia over the war in Ukraine. It's costing EU taxpayers billions of euro to house Ukrainian refugees, supply weapons to the Ukrainian army, and fund the government in Kiev. Ordinary workers will have to pay for it, but the eurozone economy is beginning to flatline.
Inflation continues to be high, even surprisingly high for both Europe and the United States. Sentiment indicators are very low, indicating a risk of recession.
It appears the European Union is now in damage control mode.
I am telling that we can work, should work, to avoid that this is a prolonged period of recession.
peace activists are calling on the EU to mediate between Russia and Ukraine, but those calls appear to be falling on deaf ears. Many people are now nervously wondering, is there an unemployment catastrophe looming in the Eurozone? Whether they are being overly pessimistic or merely realistic, there's no doubt a growing number of economists are suggesting the Eurozone is heading for a deep, prolonged recession. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
A string of humanitarian groups have slammed the Italian government for breaking international law after pushing back over 200 asylum seekers who were trying to reach a safe port in Italy. Two rescue vessels, the Humanity One and the Geo Barents, had docked in Sicily on Sunday, carrying hundreds of asylum seekers. The most vulnerable ones, women, children and ill people, were allowed to disembark, but 35 men on the Humanity One and another 215 on the Geo Barents were told to stay on board. That was made possible by the Italian authorities hastily adopting a new decree which has introduced a selective approach in deciding to disembark from the rescue boats. Italy's Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni had put migration flows in the spotlight during her first trip to Brussels last week when she asked the EU to help handle asylum seekers' arrivals on Italian coasts.
Our priorities are shifting. Italy's approach to migration will now be to defend its national borders. The matter is highly sensitive, but many EU leaders have agreed with me on this issue.
The Humanity One said it would launch legal action against the Italian government, claiming Rome's decision to not let all the asylum seekers disembark violates European law and the Geneva Refugee Convention. Meanwhile, two other boats run by non-governmental organizations remain at sea, with no ports willing to accept them. In 2017, the Italian government signed an EU-sponsored agreement with the Libyan government. The deal, which is still in place, provides that Italy and the EU help the Libyan Coast Guard enhance its maritime surveillance capacity by providing financial support and technical assets. In practical terms, under the deal, every asylum seeker intercepted at sea ends up in a Libyan detention center where torture, sexual violence and abuse are practiced.
The European member state and its citizens have been manipulated by few political heads. They do not know the facts, what is happening on the Mediterranean, what are the causes why people are forced to migrate. So when we tell this story, when we try to approach, when we try to unveil these realities, what is happening in the concentration camp in Libya, people will wake up.
Since the start of the year, about 180,000 asylum seekers have reached the EU on boats, up almost 90% compared to the year before. We are in the middle of the biggest mass migration in Europe since the end of World War II, and as distasteful as it may sound, that's also a huge business opportunity. An increasing number of people believe that refugee flows keep pouring into the old continent for the greed of those who exploit asylum seekers for profit in and outside Europe. Max Civili, Rome.
This is IRIB English Radio. Website is www.parstoday.com/en.
the supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou has made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty wise.
Now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
The U.S. midterm elections is upon the U.S., and the Republicans are almost certain that they will take back control of Congress. Meanwhile, this has been called one of the most important elections because the U.S. has never been so polarized. How severe is this polarity, and will it impact these elections? In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at why many Americans may not even accept the election results, an approach used by the former U.S. President Donald Trump, which has given rise to what's called political violence. First, let me introduce our guests for this edition of The Spotlight. Richard Becker joins us. He's an anti-war activist at the Answer Coalition, who joins us from San Francisco. Also joining us, James Jatras, former U.S. diplomat, who joins us from Belgrade.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
To you both. James DeTrost, first over to you. So we have the midterm elections. What do you think? They say it's going to be all about the economy, since Americans are dealing with inflation and high living costs. How much do you think the vote is going to be about that or about the current U.S. President Joe Biden?
Well, I think those two things go together. The fact that we have a totally incompetent president that's visible for the entire world to see, plus a very bad economic situation and inflation by all accounts, should mean a fairly decent night for the Republicans. And not only would the Republicans certainly take the House of Representatives, but very likely would take the Senate at all. But I think there are a lot of signals being sent, particularly by the Democrats, that that may not happen. I mean, Joe Biden doesn't sound like a man who expects to do badly in these elections. Rather than making his pitch to the American people, rather a few days ago, he went out and essentially threatened them and saying that if people don't accept the results of these elections, they're basically fascists, or one of his officials was speaking to Congress and saying essentially they would be agents of the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians if they don't accept the elections because they're fascists. It's very, very strange that somebody who by all rights should be expecting to do badly in an election is in a position of threatening his political opponents as, in essence, foreign agents and traitors if they question the election results. And I think we're already seeing some indications, for example, in the Senate race in Pennsylvania, which, again, by all rights, the Republican Mehmet Oz should win, that Mr. Fetterman, his opponent, the lieutenant governor, who's you know, again, it makes even Joe Biden look like a competent person, is saying that he expects the Republicans to have a really good turnout today, but over the next days or even weeks, that he expects to come out on top. So I think there's a lot of very interesting and concerning signals that are being sent.
What do you think about what our guest there from Belgrade, James Utras, is saying there, Richard Becker, in terms of how Joe Biden has said what he said? I'm sure you heard him. What do you think that means?
Well, I don't really agree with that. I mean, I'm not a supporter of Joe Biden, but I don't think Biden was threatening to manipulate the election results. I think that has been the Republican strategy over a long period of time, is to put people into place, such as secretaries of state, which there's a secretary of state in each state of the United States, and they are responsible in most cases for running elections. The Republican strategy has been to get people into those positions who have taken the position that the 2000 election was illegal, that it was not, the outcome was manipulated, and so forth. So, I mean, the problem with Biden and the Democrats is that they've squandered their opportunity to a very large degree. They have, since the Democrats took control of the House and Senate as well as the White House, in the 2000 election or following the 2000 election, they have failed to do what they said that they were going to do. They failed to carry out a program that could have really won them the support.
Why do you think that happened?
Unbeatable majority. And they, because instead of being able to carry through that agenda, they focused on things like Russiagate, so-called. I mean, these kind of ridiculous things. And that they have, as a party, are so divided among themselves that they've been unable to pass the program that had been proposed to relieve the suffering and meet the needs of the people.
Well, when you say a party that's divided, and you talk about how they've had their chance, and that now there's a missed opportunity because, as you mentioned, the focus on Russia, what issues are they divided on? that stands out so glaringly. So as you, for you to say that, I mean, in that respect, then this party, even if they retain the House or Congress, they're not going to be able to move forward that well if what you're saying is true.
Well, you know, what they're not divided on is war. The so-called Progressive Caucus in Congress, in a very mild statement a few weeks ago, where they first of all said that they were they praised Biden and the White House and the Pentagon for pouring weaponry into to Ukraine to carry out what is really a U.S. NATO proxy war against Russia, and they said, well, maybe we should have negotiations too, and they were attacked by their leaders of their own party, and these are all Democrats. They were attacked by the leaders of their own party for even suggesting that there should be negotiations instead of all-out military campaign until victory.
Sure.
At the cost of every, unlimited numbers of Ukrainian and Russian lives.
Sure. Well, this notion of democracy is something that the U.S. President Joe Biden said on the eve of the U.S. midterms. And the statement that he made is, we know in our bones that our democracy is at risk. And we know that this is your moment to defend it. So let me, James Atross is back. James Atross, Joe Biden's statements about democracy, how it's, we know in our bones that that it's at risk. And it kind of goes along with what you said, James Atross. But you would think that the stance that you made, if I'm interpreting it correctly, is something that the Republicans would kind of say, alluding to voter fraud, I'm guessing, based on some of the statements. How do you see the statement by Joe Biden vis-a-vis, of course, the Republican stance altogether?
Well, I took it as a threat. You see, here's what the paradox is that Biden is calling his enemies extremists in every respect. And the fact of the matter is, even if most Republicans think this wrongly or rightly, even if most Republicans think there was corruption in this election and the election was stolen, just as many of them think that the 2020 election was stolen, Republicans are not going to go out on the street and burn things down the way Democratic supporters burned the country down in 2020 during the BLM riots. So there's this interesting paradox where one side engages in violence and has no consequences for it. The other side doesn't engage in violence, but is treated as enemies of the people. We've seen, for example, the politicization of the FBI and of the justice system to basically take care, to treat opponents of the Biden regime as enemies. And I think, as you started the program, this is an indication of just how polarized this country has become. But the fact of the matter is, one side is using violence and using the politicization of the law enforcement structures of the federal government against its political opponents. The other side,
which side?
To have no way to really deal with that.
Which side is doing that, James Atross?
I think the left is doing that. The Biden regime and its supporters are doing that against their opponents.
Richard Brecker, I see you shaking your head. It's interesting that James Atross says the Biden regime, by the way, but go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, there were, after the murder of George Floyd by the Minneapolis police, there were demonstrations in more than 5,000 cities and towns in the United States. Less than 0.01% of those had any kind of violence, and there was no violence that ended up with people dead except at the hands of the police. And so now, on January 6th, that was not the left that stormed the Congress. That was the right wing, and led by fascist forces like the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys. They played a key role in that. I mean, this is your other guest is presenting a new falsification of history. And the reality of it is that the violence that's being threatened now is violence that's coming from the right. And it's people out like today in Arizona with automatic weapons at polling places intended to intimidate people and prevent them from voting. That's happening in many places across the country. That's what's the real threat of violence is coming from the fascists.
James Ross, go ahead.
Well, this is a perfect example of what you're talking about at the beginning of this program. Americans simply do not live in the same country anymore. We have a very polarized society. We are effectively morally aliens to one another, if not enemies. And there's nothing that's going to change that through an electoral process. And the fact of the matter is, I have to dispute what my opponent says. that in 2020, during those mostly peaceful riots that burnt out the middle of many American
riots.
Cities, about 60 people died, and they were not killed by the police, who basically allowed them to do whatever they wanted to do in Democratic-controlled cities. Only one person died on January 6th, and that was an unarmed woman shot by a policeman.
Richard Becker.
You know, here you have a mass movement, the largest mass movement in U.S. history. 34 to 35 million people participated in those protests, and they were not riots. They were protests against police brutality.
They were riots, and by the way, the police did not kill George Floyd. He was a criminal who died of a fentanyl overdose. Everybody knows this.
Richard Becker.
Oh. Really, it wasn't the knee on the throat.
No, because he was saying I can't breathe while he was still standing up and not getting in the police car. He's saying I can't breathe while he was standing there. Somebody who can't breathe is not saying I can't breathe.
Okay, so we're seeing right now the breakdown amongst you two to be representative. I'm guessing a mirror image of what many Americans think about each other. And it's interesting that you say it's not that James Atrasi said that you were living amongst aliens in the States, as you mentioned, but you're living in another planet. How did it get to the point where the polarization is not so much an exchange of thoughts as what many polls are indicating that this has to involve some kind of violence? And the reference is being made to the most recent incident that happened with Nancy Pelosi's husband. I mean, where does that line get crossed where violence comes into the picture in the States in this case?
It's clearly the right
way.
Who is
that director?
I'm sorry. This is for James Dutras. Richard Becker, I'm sorry. I'm going to come to you with that same question. James Dutras, go ahead.
Well, I think let's take this Pelosi thing for an example. All the indications we've seen is that this unhinged gentleman who was caught in this very odd situation with Mr. Pelosi was some kind of a LGBT nudist activist of some sort, very much on the left wing, if he had any politics at all. He seems to be a rather flaky individual. What kind of relationship, if any, he had with Mr. Pelosi, I don't know. Yet this is somehow being turned into by the mainstream media, which is essentially regime media that's in the pocket of the big corporations that, oddly enough, left-wing people in this country now support because it supports all their rainbow, homosexual, transgender agenda, which they want to impose on this country and, let's be honest, on the rest of the world. That somehow we've got woke capitalism in a kind of a fascist relationship with a left-wing regime that wants to suppress the American people, who are mostly passive, are not doing anything, are not threatening violence, but are being accused of being violent extremists.
You know, there's some points
That's
of views there.
In this position.
Thank you, James Atrasi. Richard Becker, some points of views there that James Atrasi has relayed, from LGBTQs to, if I said that correctly in that order, to the other opinions that he just said. And again, these are things that he said that the left-wing regime, I guess, is what you said, is being exercised on the Americans. Do you feel that way? Do you agree with that?
No, not at all. And the person who attacked Nancy Pelosi's husband was a left-wing conspiracy theorist, of who they are, who evolved into a right-wing, an extreme right-wing conspiracy theorist. And that's why he carried out the attack that he did. And that's why he carried out what he was hoping would be an attack on Nancy Pelosi. And again, I'm not a supporter of Nancy Pelosi or the Democratic Party, but I think that there's no question that that's what happened. And this idea
right.
that there's a homosexual agenda is complete. That's a theory that has no
Richard
basis
Becker, quick
in
question.
Scientific reality.
Why isn't anybody for Nancy Pelosi? It seems like that's something that's been going on for quite some time.
Well, she has her supporters. As I said, I'm not a Democrat, but there are, you know, there's a very large Democratic Party that does support Nancy Pelosi. And the person who attacked her and who sought to attack her and did attack her husband
right.
Was not from the left. He was a person who had been persuaded by these conspiracy theories that somehow there was this agenda that was going on, and it was meant to turn everyone into pedophiles or something. I mean, it's complete garbage. It's just ridiculous garbage. But mm-hmm. that's what's being passed around as a real political outlook.
James Atrasi, go ahead if you have a reaction.
Yeah. It's a conspiracy. Huh? Just Google drag queen story hour. Just Google family-friendly drag queen shows and seeing what's being normalized in American schools, telling kids that they should dress up or transition, as they say, into another sex. This is being supported by the Biden regime. I do call it a regime, by the corporations. And this is America's agenda abroad. This is what we're trying
percentage?
To force on countries. We talk about countries like Ukraine, for example, talking about countries in Eastern Europe, in Serbia, where I am at the moment. This is the kind of agenda that this sick regime is trying to push on the American people and on the rest of the world. And a lot of ordinary Americans don't like it. And my only complaint is, we don't know what to do about it because we're talking about honest, law-abiding people, family people, married people with kids, church-going people who don't like these kind of values.
James Atross, when you say that, what percentage, if you were to take a guess, unless you know a solid fact from a source, does America fall into the lines that you just said that are for or against what you said?
Well, see, that's the trouble. I think we don't really know. I think, unfortunately, it basically breaks down to about half and half with more extreme elements on either side. I would say more people on the right side are basically just sort of normal people who just want to live their lives and not accept this agenda. Is that a majority of the population? Probably not anymore. Maybe 35, maybe 40% of the population, but maybe another 10 or 20% will vote along with them. Same thing on the other side. I'm sure you have some very radical fringe on the left that espouses all of these values, but another 30, 40% of the population will vote along with them because they think they're voting for compassion or tolerance or any of these things. But the bottom line to me is that which side is the big money and the political power on? It's on the side of the left.
Mm-hmm. Some of the things that Richard Becker, obviously, that James Atross said, I'm sure would not fly in San Francisco. But since we just have a few minutes left over here, let's move on to the foreign policy arena and see what's going to happen there. I mean, if all indications come out to be true in terms of the Republicans taking control of the Senate or the House or both, what are we looking at when it comes to, for example, issues like Iran?
Well, unfortunately, there is a bipartisan foreign policy of the United States, and it's an imperialist foreign policy. And so we have Trump having, in regard to Iran, having shut down, walked out of the JCPOA unilaterally, really a violation of that treaty. We have Trump having increased the imposition of sanctions, 243 new sanctions on Cuba, causing great suffering to the people. It's increasing the sanctions on Iran, doing the same thing. But then you have Biden, who when he was running, said he was going to change those policies, and he has not. So there's no new JCPOA. There's still sanctions on Iran. There's a maintenance of the sanctions blockade against Cuba. And there is foreign policy that is getting bipartisan support for the U.S.-NATO proxy war against Russia, a war that really threatens the whole world with nuclear destruction, and a war that needs to come to an end. And can only come to an end, not based on a decision by Zelensky, who I think is the president of Ukraine, who I think is just a puppet, but it's the refusal of the U.S. and NATO to negotiate, going all the way back to last year, when there was an opportunity for that, and instead has fueled this war. And that's a Republican and Democratic joint project.
Keep hearing about Republicans, James Atross, that are going to tone down the aid, military aid or assistance overall, perhaps, to Ukraine. Are we really looking at that happening? Were they to take control?
No, I don't think so. And this is where I do agree with my colleague on the program, is that we do have two warmongering parties. And even though I think there will be more Trump-type mega populists who are being demonized by the other side, they really are the only ones that might be somewhat opposed to some of this stuff, but even they will be a tiny minority. In the Republican office holders, the leadership will be even more warmongering than the Democrats are. And, of course, the left wing of the Democratic Party that used to be a peace wing of the Democratic Party has totally collapsed. We had that fiasco a few weeks ago where a number of left-wing members, you know, the progressive bloc in the House, had written urging, just mildly urging negotiations and were forced to retract it because their betters in the party, I guess, to hold them down. So it's really sad. We have some populist right opposition to these things, but it's very small, and it's not really going to have much of an impact. My only fear is that the Republicans take the Congress, and that they'll simply demand even more money for Ukraine, more militancy in global affairs. So unfortunately, I think my colleagues, he and I agree on this.
Okay. Final question. I see we have some time here. I'm going to go back to what you had a UN special rapporteur say back in the year 2020, where he decried near tyranny in U.S. against minority voting rights. Richard Becker, electoral laws in some part of the U.S., like Texas, may undermine democracy by depriving millions of citizens the equal right to vote. Are we going to look at that happen perhaps this time, or is this a norm, or what do you think about this? Again, this was something that came out based on a report back in 2020.
It's very widespread, and it's aimed at particularly at black voters, also Latino voters, to restrict their access to voting. After years of trying to of expanding the access, now there have been in many states restrictions that have been put into place. And I think this is because the right wing can't really win the elections anymore if everyone gets to vote. And you know who said that? Donald Trump. He said that a few years ago. He said, if we let everybody vote, the Republicans will never win another election. So the strategy is, let's shut down voting rights. Let's make voting more difficult. Why does voting even take place in the United States on a Tuesday, today? Why not and why isn't it a national holiday? So, because it makes it so much more difficult.
Let me give 30 seconds to James Dutras. James Dutras, in closing, anything you'd like to say?
I would agree with my colleague on moving elections from Tuesday to a Saturday or a Sunday. If he will agree with me that people to register to vote must not only provide proof of their identity, but proof of their citizenship, which simply does not happen. What he talks about, what ballot security measures are designed to make sure that people who are voting are actually citizens of the United States and actually who they are, who they say they are. Instead, what we get is the massive dumping of mail-in ballots,
right,
which is an open recipe for fraud.
Thank you, James Dutras, former U.S. diplomat from Belgrade. Richard Becker, thank you. Anti-war activist, Answer Coalition, San Francisco. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. From Miko Vitale and the team, it's goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
Economic recession and inflation, high cost of living and poor performance of the government all means that the British people are facing difficulties with their current living conditions. This has prompted labour unions, students, nurses and young people to go on strike against the current situation. The British protesters say it's all the result of more than a decade of Conservative rule, and the time has come for a change. We take a look at some of the world media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Forbes magazine has more for us. Britain's beleaguered health services face yet another blow as the country's main nursing union looks to have voted in favour of industrial action. The Royal College of Nursing asked its 300,000 members to strike over pay in a ballot that ended recently. Although official results have not yet been announced, sources have told several UK publications nurses have largely agreed to the industrial action. If a strike goes ahead, it will be the first ever walkout of its kind. The move would put extra pressure on already intensely overstretched health services, exacerbating twin crises in emergency and non-urgent care. As hospitals struggle to get on top of lengthy waiting lists, a strike would likely lead to further cancellations of appointments. But union leaders say nurses in emergency care would continue to work if industrial action goes ahead. This includes those working in life-preserving services like critical care, continuing therapeutic care, and urgent diagnostics. The Royal College of Nursing wants to strike over what it argues are inadequate pay rises offered by the government earlier this year. Union leaders argue the rising cost of living in the United Kingdom dwarfs the salary boosts offered to nurses who have endured extremely challenging working conditions throughout the pandemic. The government says that a nurse's average basic salary would rise from roughly £35,600 to £37,000 from March of this year. This is an increase of about 4%. But union leaders have asked for a much larger increase that takes into account soaring levels of inflation. They want a pay rise of 5% above inflation, which currently stands at around 13%. Union leaders say pay increases are needed not just to help nurses battle the cost of living crisis, but to make the overall workforce itself more resilient. Britain's hospitals are seriously understaffed, with tens of thousands of nursing vacancies currently unfilled. Other major health unions, including Unison, are also considering industrial action over pay. The Royal College of Nursing General Secretary and Chief Executive, Pat Cullen, said in a statement, "Patients are at great risk when there aren't enough nurses. Huge numbers of staff, both experienced and new recruits, are deciding they cannot see a future in the nursing profession and that is not valued nor treated fairly. Our strike action will be as much for patients as it is for nurses. We have their support in doing this. As we begin industrial action, politicians in every part of the United Kingdom will be challenged to back their nursing staff and understand the strength of public support." The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. Britain's University and College Union, UCU, said on Tuesday, 8th of November, over 70,000 university staff will go on strike action in the coming days over pay, working conditions and pensions. Britain's University and College Union, UCU, said the strikes will be held on 24th, 25th and 30th of November, with staff at 150 universities across the United Kingdom taking part in the walkouts. The University and College Union, General Secretary Joe Grady said in a statement on the union's website, campuses across the United Kingdom about to experience strike action on a scale never seen before. Joe Grady noted, 70,000 staff will walk out and make clear they refuse to accept falling pay, cuts to pensions and insecure employment. This is not a dispute about affordability, it is about choices. Vice-chancellors are choosing to pay themselves hundreds of thousands of pounds whilst forcing our members onto low-paid and insecure contracts that leave some using food banks. They choose to hold billions in surpluses while slashing staff pensions. The strikes are expected to lead to the cancellation of lectures and disruption to courses for nearly 2.5 million university students. However, the union said disruption can be avoided if employers act fast and make improved offers. If they don't, strike action will escalate in the new year alongside a marking and assessment boycott. The University and College Union demands a pay rise due to the cost of living crisis following the offer of a pay increase starting at 3% and an end to insecure contracts. The union also wants a reversal of cuts to sector pensions imposed this year, which it says will see the average member lose around 35% from future retirement income. The British newspaper The Guardian has more for us. According to the City Watchdog, which said a growing proportion of the UK's population is having trouble making ends meet, millions of people are also struggling to pay their bills. A survey by the Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, laid bare the impact of the cost of living crisis in Britain, saying about 1 in 4 or 24% of adults in the United Kingdom were either in financial difficulty or would fall into trouble if they suffered a financial shock. The Financial Conduct Authority, FCA, found that about 7.8 million people were finding it a heavy burden to keep up with their bills, an increase of about 2.5 million people since 2020, as wage growth failed to keep pace with soaring inflation, which is currently at a 40-year high, currently at 10.1%. Meanwhile, 4.2 million people had missed bills or loan payments in the 6 months before the survey took place, in the 4 months between February and June of this year. The financial challenges were concentrated in more deprived areas across the United Kingdom, with people in economically challenged regions roughly 7 times more likely to be in financial difficulty than their peers elsewhere. About 12% of people in the northeast of England and 10% in the northwest of England were struggling financially, compared with 6% of people in the southeast of England and in the southwest of England. The statistics were gathered as part of the FCA's Financial Lives Survey, which polled more than 19,000 people and will be published in full in early 2023. The government is believed to be considering raising benefits in line with wage growth of 5.5% rather than inflation, which would put further pressure on already struggling households. The Resolution Foundation think tank has said it would have stark consequences for families, with a single disabled adult on universal credit likely to lose £380, while a working single parent with one child would lose £478 a year. A working couple with 3 children would lose £978 a year. Sheldon Mills, a director overseeing consumer and competition issues at the Financial Conduct Authority, said, "Our research shows that people up and down the country are struggling to keep up with their bills. If you're facing financial difficulty, you do not need to struggle alone. There is free debt advice available, and we have told firms they must work with their customers to solve any problems with payments."
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.